Blog Talk Radio.
Bring back memories? It should. Good evening, Eastern family and friends. Welcome to the Eastern Radio Show and our 40th radio episode coming to you live tonight from Jacksonville, Florida, Roaring Gap, North Carolina, and Grand Junction, Colorado. I'm Margaret Barrs, one of your hosts for tonight's show. Our other hosts are Neil Holland and Bud Hescock in Jacksonville, Steve Thompson in Roaring Gap, North Carolina, Bill Joseph in Grand Junction, Colorado. And, of course, our producer-engineer is Eric Otero, computer wizard extraordinaire. Now, you may call us tonight at either of our two phone numbers, 213-816-1611, or you may call us toll-free at 877-572-1861. You may also send us a message on the chat feature of the webpage you're logged into. Either way, we want to hear from you. Now, we try to bring you stories each week from Eastern's past, from those who participated in its history. Our lines are open right after the program that we have for you tonight, in case you've wondered just who is Eastern Airlines. Now, you may know most of the history of Eastern, from Captain Eddie to Colonel Borman to Frank Lorenzo. But do you know how we got to be the second largest airline in the free world? Let's see if we can add to your knowledge of Eastern Airlines history.
Steve, what was the very beginning of Eastern Airlines, as there have been a few name changes along the way? Can you shed some light on the very, very beginning?
Thank you, Neil. I'll try to state, in the beginning, as one of the most popular books ever written starts out declaring. Let's start with Florida Airways back in 1926. Reed Chambers and Eddie Rickenbacker, both famous World War I fighter pilots, formed Florida Airways on November 3rd, 1925. Eddie was the most famous of the two, being the leading American aces in the war, but Chambers was the business brains behind in the new company. He took over the 94th Pursuit Squadron from Captain Eddie when he left the war. Another key person in this venture was another ace, Arthur Ray Brooks, and Major William Robertson, who also served in the war. Among the first investors were Percy Rockeller, Charles Stone, Charles Hayden, Richard Hoyt, and Ann Morgan. Ford Trimotor Company, or Ford Motor Company, invested in the new venture by providing four all-metal Ford Stout II-AT transport planes. On the inaugural flight, one of the planes was caught in a vicious crosswind and hit the other three airplanes. That airplane, known as Miss Fort Myers, was cannibalized to patch up the other three. On February 3, 1926, Florida Airways was awarded a CAM-10 airmail contract from Miami to Jacksonville via Fort Myers and Tampa. Now, the major problem the airline had was the lack of suitable airfields. Passenger service began June 1, 1926, and was extended beyond Jacksonville to Atlanta. Well, bad luck prevailed on the opening of this service when a hurricane hit Miami and demolished another 2-ATs. The volume fell off and the revenues were not enough to pay expenses, so Florida Airways suspended service December 31, 1926. Chamber and Rockefeller sold what was left to Juan Trippi's newly formed Pan American Airways. The first route for the eventual Eastern Airlines was Miami, Fort Myers, Tampa, Jacksonville, Macon, and Atlanta. Now to tell us how Florida Airways eventually became Eastern Airlines, Bill Joseph continues our airline family tree. Bill, what happened next in our story?
As you mentioned, Steve, with Florida Airways' demise and suspension of airmail service from Miami to Atlanta, service from Atlanta to New York was imminent, and CAM-19 was awarded to Pitcairn Aviation February 1, 1927, and on November 23, 1927, he was awarded the old dormant route once owned by Florida Airways and renumbered to CAM-25. Harold Pitcairn of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, was now the owner of the potentially most lucrative route in the United States and would later be dubbed the Gravy Run. Pitcairn was able to provide his own aircraft for his new airline since he was also an aircraft manufacturer. Under the terms of his contract, he had to provide service no later than March 1, 1928. However, by consent, the service did not begin until May 1, 1928, mainly because of lack of airfield preparation, but also because of the lighted airway system about to be installed, as most of the Pitcairn operations was to be at night. The base of operations for the new award was Richmond, Virginia, and it began operating with an initial fleet of 8 Pitcairn mail wings. The first month of operations, the new airline made $25,700 in airmail revenue. Business was so brisk that a shuttle service was introduced between New York and Philadelphia, and then on to Miami. There was no room for passengers in the Pitcairn mail wing, which became so popular that other carriers had ordered it from Pitcairn. On March 1, 1929, a branch line was opened from Tampa to Daytona Beach, and a few days later, shuttle service was extended to Baltimore and Washington. Pitcairn was a story of true success, as within 1 year it had flown the fourth largest airmail, it had become the fourth largest airmail carrier in the nation, and third largest in miles flown. And this was in mail business only. Clement M. Keyes, a forceful entrepreneur, had ambition to create a nationwide airline network, and when the new Airmail Act of 1925 was passed, providing that airmail payments would now be paid based on volume rather than by the pound, he saw an opportunity to buy the entire Pitcairn Airways with much negotiations with Pitcairn. On July 12, 1929, a deal was struck for Clement's North American Aviation Corporation to pay Pitcairn $2.5 million. Pitcairn was satisfied to remain as an aircraft manufacturer, which included his autogyros rights acquired for North American from Juan Sierva. Air routes of Pitcairn Aviation 1928 to 1929 was Miami, West Palm Beach, Daytona Beach, with a branch to Orlando and Tampa, Jacksonville, Macon, Atlanta, Spartanburg, Greensboro, Richmond, Washington, Baltimore, Philadelphia, Newark, New York City. But how about taking us from here as we are nearing a major branding change in Eastern's history?
That's right, Bill and Steve. Let's try that again. That's right, Bill and Steve. We are getting closer to our long-recognized and popular industry brand name of Eastern Airlines. But first, let's see what the next step that led to our very popular and identifiable future name. Having bought Pitcairn's airline operation July 12, 1929, North American Aviation moved the executive offices from Philadelphia to New York in the Sperry Building in Brooklyn. Pitcairn became a wholly owned subsidiary of New York and Atlantic Seaboard Express, and on January 13, 1930, the name was changed to Eastern Air Transport. Clements Keyes recognized the great potential of passenger carrying and the new airmail routes under pending new legislation being discussed in the highest levels. Using initially the Fokker F-10s and Ford Tri-Motors,
under varying leases, agreements, it was not until December 1939 that the 18-passenger Condors became available and went into service on the New York to Washington route. The 7-seat Kingbird opened the service on through to Atlanta July 1, 1931. Service was extended from Atlanta to Miami via Jacksonville. At the end of 1931, the airline had carried 32,000 passengers, although it wanted to be part of the transcontinental air route, mail routes, which were frustrated by the Postmaster General Walter Brown. Eastern Air Transport had to be most lucrative on all routes, New York to Miami. The vacation-oriented route became known as the Gravy Run, and it made direct connection with all of Latin American-bound traffic at Miami and Pan American Airways. In addition, it was already existing routes, flights from Jacksonville to Savannah, Charleston to Florence, Raleigh-Durham to Richmond were added. July 15, 1931, New York Airways was sold to Eastern Air Transport by Pan American, and Washington, Baltimore, Atlantic, and New York, North Beach were added. With such marketing assets, Eastern's future was assured. Neil, take us to the rest of the way from how General Motors and Captain Eddie got into the Eastern story.
Thanks, Bud. Not only was there an ever-changing development of Eastern, but all of the carriers back in the 30s were being bought and sold, with new corporate players coming on the scene with each changeover. General Motors purchased control of North American from Clement Keyes when his health deteriorated and he overreached himself through his investments. February 28, 1933, General Motors purchased the control of North American for $3,676,000, and in addition, it controlled Western Air Express and Transcontinental Western Air, which is known as TWA. In essence, about one-third of the United States air transport industry was owned by General Motors. In February of 1933, Eastern Air Transport took over Ludington Airlines, which had as one of its directors Amelia Earhart. The routes were from Newark, Trenton, Camden, Wilmington, Baltimore, Washington, Norfolk, Charlottesville, Lynchburg, Roanoke, Bristol, Knoxville, and Nashville. This airline had as its slogan on the New York, Philadelphia, Washington route, on the hour, every hour. This was a slogan that was to pass into the airline vocabulary as the accepted standard for good airline service. The slogan became so popular with the Eastern Shuttle later in Eastern's history that it did use that very slogan, on the hour, every hour. What became known as the airmail scandal in early 1934 and President Franklin Roosevelt canceling all airmail contracts, the U.S. Army Air Corps was called out to fly the mail until a solution could be made to the unfair discrimination of air service that smaller airlines claim existed. Several planes and pilots of the Army Air Corps were lost, causing the president to quickly recognize the political danger, and on March 30, 1934, new bids were invited for the coveted airmail routes. As a matter of fact, Captain Eddie Rickenbacker said it was a legal way of suicide, the way it was being operated by the Army Air Corps pilots. Eastern Air Transport did well, but one of the requirements was that it had to change its name to Eastern Airlines to comply with the terms of the new contracts. It not only retained its gravy run from the Northeast to Florida, direct and by Atlanta, but it was a successful bidder for routes from Chicago to Florida, thus tapping the Great Lakes area. It also gained an extension to its Route 5 to New Orleans. By the time the Airmail Act of 1934 was settled, Eastern was in control of all the main routes east of the Mississippi, except from the Northeast to the Great Lakes, and it was poised to take its place as one of the big four airlines of the United States. Only 4 years earlier, Eastern had just begun passenger service. The Pitcairn mail wings were soon replaced by the revolutionary Douglas DC-2. The little sturdy mail plane flew its last flight October 16th, 1935. In addition to the highly lucrative routes, Eastern established a hub in Atlanta, which was to become an aerial crossroad. Atlanta was to become, in some years, the busiest airport in the world. When Eastern Airlines took over the assets of North American Aviation, Captain Eddie Rickenbacker was named general manager of Eastern. Eastern Air Transport was legally dissolved February 28, 1935. Can you add some more to that, Bill?
In addition to Ludington Airlines, Eastern also acquired Weedell Williams Air Service, which brought in routes to Texas from New Orleans. Cities along the two major routes operated by Weedell Williams were Baton Rouge, Beaumont, Houston, San Antonio, Laredo on the south route, and Alexandria, Natchitoches, Shreveport, Dallas, Fort Worth, Wichita Falls, Oklahoma City, and Tulsa on the north route. Weedell Williams was purchased by Eastern December 1, 1936. Eastern offered to purchase Colonial Air Transport June 26, 1952, but it was denied twice, but finally approved June 1, 1956. Eastern gained Colonial's routes from New York to Hartford, to Boston, and north to Albany, Schenectady, Utica, Syracuse, Rochester, Buffalo, Toronto, and west to Erie and Cleveland. Also, Eastern gained Colonial's route from New York and Washington to Bermuda. It should also be noted that Colonial received the very first CAM award, CAM number one, to fly mail from New York to Boston. Steve?
Yes, Joe Mackey sold his Mackey Airlines to Eastern on November 22, 1966, with the understanding that he was not to compete in any airline activity for 5 years. From Miami, Fort Lauderdale, Tampa, and Palm Beach, Eastern flew the Bahamas, the Bahamian cities of Andrewstown, Nassau, Harbor Island, Marsh Harbor, Green Turtle Cay, Bellamy, Freeport, and West End. Well, wouldn't you know it, Joe Mackey started up again 5 years later with Mackey International. Who would have guessed? Eastern, still wanting to expand throughout the Caribbean, made an offer to purchase Caribair Airlines, that's Caribbean Atlantic Airlines, October 27, 1970. But with contention from Premier, it was finally settled March 15, 1973. Caribair was founded by Dionisio Trigo February 27, 1939. With this purchase, Eastern basically owned the Caribbean, with flights to nearly all the Caribbean islands from its hub in San Juan, routes to St. Thomas, St. Croix, St. Martin, Antigua, Pointe Pitre, St. Lucia, Barbados, Port of Spain, Curacao, and I'll comment on that later, Aruba to the south, and Santo Domingo, Port-au-Prince, Kingston, Montego to the west. But you're from New England in the Boston area. How about telling our listeners about the listeners of Eastern Express service we had with PBA?
Yeah, now we'll talk about my generation here. PBA, Provincetown Boston Airlines, and which was later merged with Bar Harbor Airlines, was an agreement with Eastern and Continental Express signed May 1987 to provide feeder service from many smaller New England cities to Boston and New York. It operated mostly with Beech 99s and 1900s, Convair 600s, and Casa 212s. PBA also had a Florida operation which took aircraft from its chilly northeast operation and put them in the south during the winter vacation traffic. Miami, Marathon, Key West to the south, and on the Florida west coast, the cities of Tampa, Sarasota, Punta Gorda, Fort Myers, Naples, and part of the express service. Eastern Airlines can claim to have been the first major airline to adopt a commuter airline in a code-sharing partnership. This was with Metro Airlines out of Houston, Texas, in October 1983. it was officially redesignated Eastern Metro Express. The hubs of operation were Atlanta, Houston, and Dallas. De Havilland Dash 8s and BA Jetstream 31s were used on the routes served. Supplementing Eastern's Caribbean connections, Sun Air, based in St. Croix, became the Eastern Metro Express carrier. Atlantis Airlines served to connect Eastern with the mid-Atlantic states of Atlanta and Charlotte. The airline, based in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, was the first airline to be formed after 1978 Airline Deregulation Act. It was purchased by Metro Express February 15, 1989, and another Eastern Express company. Steve?
Well, the Eastern two major international awards were South America and the Atlantic to London. South America was flown out of Miami to Barranquilla, Panama City, Bogota, Cali, Quito, Guayaquil, Lima, La Paz, Santiago, and Buenos Aires. These routes were awarded to Eastern when President Reagan approved a CAB decision to transfer the routes to Eastern. Pan American was overlooked as Washington did not wish to restore the monopoly that Pan American had on South America. We used Boeing 727, 757s, Lucky 1011s, and DC-10 aircraft on South American operation. Miami to London was awarded to Eastern July 5, 1985, and it began service using a McDonnell Douglas DC-10 aircraft. This is the Eastern family tree as written by the late R.E.G. Davis in his book Eastern, an Airline and Its Aircraft. We hope you have enjoyed tonight's presentation.
And we hope you've enjoyed the Eastern family tree. If you'd like to tell us on the air of any memories you may have of this historical company tree, please call us at area code 213-816-1611 or call us toll free 877-572-1861. We'd like to hear them.
Would you repeat those numbers again, Margaret?
I certainly will. That's area code 213-816-1611 or 877-572-1861.
Okay, thanks so much. We really hope that you learned a little of Eastern's early history and perhaps up to the time you came on with Eastern. I was hired February 1963, and I can remember it as clearly as this morning's breakfast. This was one of the largest of my life's benchmarks, and I'm sure you remember the events leading to your own employment with Eastern. Since we have in our broadcast studio tonight the one and only Luann Wiggins, or should I say, old pretty woman, perhaps she can tell us about her memories of Air Kentucky.
Hey, everybody out there in radio land. Well, Captain Neal, I can remember the very day I was hired by Air Kentucky. My best friend Margaret told me she heard a new airline was starting up in Kentucky, and I ought to take a look into flying as a stewardess. She sure loves her job with Eastern, and she's always been talking about the pilots and the mechanics and all those other airline folks she's met. She said it was like working for a big family. Personally, though, I prefer a small family, and Air Kentucky sounded like it would be right down my alley.
Hey, it looks like we have a caller from Kentucky, and it's area code 859. Caller, are you on the line?
Hey, y'all. This is Captain Leon Hopper. I was one who hired Luann. She answered nearly all the application questions correctly, and after one intense one-day training on our little red Learjet, she was a real good asset to the company. She had a hard time getting used to walking up and down the aisle, though, in a crouched position, as she was nearly 6 feet tall, you know. Luann could actually feel the county that we were flying over, and whether to serve alcohol drinks or not. Several of our counties are dry counties where you can't serve drinks even if you're in the ire. Luann had an uncanny sense at all times as to where we were when flying in Kentucky. She had what I call cat sense. You could throw her up in there, and she would always land on her feet.
Why, hello there, Captain Leon. I see you still have your sense of humor. I reckon it has been a long while since we've seen each other. Now, Captain Leon, you know darn well it took me longer to become a steward than you let on. That there Learjet's a right complicated little airplane with what with all them fancy lights and that control panel. It was hard work going back and forth to that little refrigerator on the plane. But I do like the way you guys have decorated that cockpit, though.
Are you talking about that hairy dice we had hanging down from the magnetic compass or that little St. Christopher medal that just in case we were unsure? We have that on top of the glare shield. Or did you like those leopard skin seat covers on our jet?
Well, yes, and them too. But can I ask you, why did you all get those glass pack mufflers and put them on that plane? You know, those engines sounded awfully good to me just the way they was. And why did you paint the sides of the engine with what looks like flames coming around? You guys must be NASCAR nuts. But I do hope you're still using the clever little announcement when the passengers arrive at their Kentucky destination, because, you know, we put that into the flight attendant's manual. And folks out there in Radio Land, it went something like this. We'd like to thank you folks for flying with us today. And the next time, get the insane urge to go zipping through the skies of Kentucky in a pressurized metal tube with dual glass packs, we hope you will think of us here at Air Kentucky. Bye-bye.
Okay.
Well,
I do think we do have a caller here, area code 410. Don't know if caller 410, area code, are you with us? Area code 410, just press 1, and you're live with us. Can you identify yourself? Well, must be just listening, I guess.
That's okay.
Margaret, you have got some special features.
I just, first of all, wanted to say thank you, Luann and Captain Harper, for that memorable walk down the lane. But now, folks, I would like to tell you about a new feature that we have on our radio show. Each week, we will be welcoming our new radio club members. And in September, we had the following join our radio family. We had Janie from
New Jersey,
Carlos,
Star, North Carolina,
Kathy Smith Casurinas,
Fairfax, Virginia,
Greg,
California,
Kathy Salzman,
Concord, North Carolina,
Charles Allen,
Sarasota, Florida,
Jim Nugent,
Boston, Massachusetts,
John Batista Sr.,
and that's Pine Brook Pines Fall, Florida, and excuse me,
Carlisle Rodenbeck,
Deltona, Florida.
And Brenda McCullough.
Jasper, Alabama.
And so far this month, we welcome the following. Carolyn Leonhard.
From Miami Beach.
Margarita Perez.
Elizabeth, New Jersey.
Linda Brownsville.
Atlanta, Georgia.
Jim.
Orange Park, Florida.
Alex.
Get this. Moscow, Russia.
Bill Aldrich.
Lake City, Florida.
Bruce.
It just says Florida.
Joseph Kukur.
From the USA.
Maryland.
Orlando, Florida.
Tony.
Melbourne.
Wenda Rushton.
Orange Park, Florida.
Jane Boyle.
Chicago, Illinois.
R.L. Stevens.
Southwest Florida.
David Kennedy.
USA.
Skip.
Salem, Wisconsin.
Jim Duncan.
South Carolina.
Rowley.
Phoenix.
Helene Pizer.
Fort Mill, South Carolina.
And Tracker.
Family member of the late Warren Jameson from Memphis.
Now, just a reminder, listeners, it would be nice if you would give us your name and the city and state when you do register as a new club member. Our site is very secure for that reason. And by the way, if I did mispronounce your name tonight, why don't you call in and correct me? And we would love to absolutely talk with you.
Now, I'm not going to make her sound bad, but the numbers are 1-213-816-1611 or call us 1-877-572-1611. 1-800-516-1861. That's toll free.
And not to upstage you, Bud, but just so that the listeners out there who I think can understand me better is Luann, that's area code 213-816-1611 or toll free 877-572-1861. And Captain Leon Harper, you know, you need to call back again.
Bill, how are things out there in Grand Junction, Colorado?
Things are fine. The leaves are falling off the tree and the temperatures are coming down, Neil, but the humidity is always low.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Nice. Yeah. You don't have a Air Colorado, do you?
No, we don't, but we maybe will get one as a an add-on, just as Eastern Airlines had the add-ons of the smaller airlines over the years.
Yeah. Well, I know if you do an Air Colorado, I don't think I can talk Colorado, but I might could learn. This is Luann. I'd like to make application.
Well, we have 5 questions, and I'll write them down for you and let you practice them.
Oh, I certainly will, sir.
But yeah. We don't have any dry counties, so it could be easier for you out here.
Oh, thank God. That Kentucky test was just something fierce. It was just awful. I had to study for 3 months on them 5 questions.
We all had problems on that test, Luann.
Yeah, I think one of the questions ought to be, what's at the top of Pike's Peak?
Yeah.
Or what is Pike's Peak?
Yeah.
But I bet you can see it out your window, though, Bill. I don't know.
Well, you know. We're in a valley, and I'm a long way from the Continental Divide, but it's a nice area of the country to live in.
Yeah. I remember using that as an alternate one time for United, and I finally got the chance to go in there. It's a beautiful, beautiful area with the mountains off to the, I guess, to the northeast of us. I couldn't believe how high they were, and I knew I could get in, but I wasn't sure I was going to get out. But it was a beautiful.
You know, the military uses this airport for a lot of operations right now too, because of the fact that we don't have a lot of commercial air service here at all, and as a result, they can come and go, and they can do the touch and goes, and they bring quite a number of aircraft in and out of here through the course of a week.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
Yeah, Steve, you're in a different area of mountains. You're close to the Eastern Continental Divide, I guess.
Yes, and I'm telling you, we just experienced enjoying what God made for himself. I think I say himself. The leaves are absolutely brilliant, and too, they have just begun to fall here. But the temperature today was 80 degrees. And I listened to the forecast tonight, and they're talking about a few snow flurries 2 days from now at near where we are here in the mountains. But it's just an absolutely beautiful, beautiful spot.
Let me interrupt for a second. We have a caller, area code 317. If you'd press 1 and identify yourself, we'd love to hear from you. 317, area code. Press 1 and talk into your phone. And we would love to hear from you, hear what you have to say.
Okay.
Well, we tried.
Must be just listening.
Yeah, that's okay.
A lot of folks listen. And if at any time you want to say something, area code 317, just come right on out and talk what's on your mind.
That same thing with area code 410. We'd love to hear from both of you.
Both of you.
That's right.
I have a story, Neil, if you'll... give me just 1 second to tell you about the route that we acquired in the Caribbean. I was a captain on a flight going to Aruba. Now, I had never been there before, and I looked down at the papers, and it shows one of the stops that we're going to be making is a place whose spelling was C-U-R-A-C-A-O. So it's time now to pick up the mic and make a PA announcement. And I think it went something like this. Ladies and gentlemen, just like to welcome you aboard our flight number 999 to Aruba. And our next stop will be Curacao. And just a matter of a few seconds later, somebody taps me on the shoulder, and it's a flight attendant. And I turn around, and she says, "It's not Curacao. It's Curacao."
Curacao.
Yes.
And that's the way they pronounce it. Well, you know, I was corrected when I used to call it Antigua. It's Antigua.
What is Antigua?
That's right.
Yes, Antigua. Yes. But I used to always say Antigua. Antigua. Antigua.
That's why they looked at me funny.
Yeah, when you said Antigua. Yeah. But anyhow, yeah, it's interesting how you pronounce. I could never pronounce that city, or not city, but island that you said it was. What was it?
Petra?
Yeah, Petra.
Yeah.
The spelling just didn't look right to me. So we got it up on the screen. Our producer is showing us all the islands in the Caribbean right now. And, do I miss those islands. It was a lot of fun to fly down there. It really was. Where do we get our chocolates, by the way? In St. Martin. St. Martin and St. Croix. I think St. Martin had the chocolates.
St. Martin. Was it St. Martin you took off, and if you couldn't, what was it? If you're too heavy, you would go. You'd have to go between the mountains to get out.
Yeah, well, I know that, but you always took off. Well, on the St. Thomas is the one we had mountains at the end of the runway down there where the – who was it that ran into the gas station? Steve, do you remember the DC-9? That
was American.
Was it American?
I don't remember that, but I remember it happening, yes.
Yeah. But that was a fun airport to operate out of, St. Thomas,
yes,
because of the short runway. And we flew the 757 in there, and you could set it to maximum brakes, and the airplane would actually stop midway on the runway. It was such a fantastic braking airplane, especially the auto brakes on that airplane were just phenomenal. And, I mean, they put you forward when that airplane touched down.
Oh, yeah.
And, of course, we had the auto brake system on the 1011 and the A300 as well, because you had to have that Category 3 operations. But some of the great flying that I really enjoyed, I never did want to fly overseas. Oh, I guess I did, but you know the Caribbean. If you flew those trips through the islands, a lot of guys bid just flying down there. It was just so much fun.
Oh, I liked it.
Yeah,
I was lucky. I got to fly everywhere.
Yeah, you flew overseas as well.
Yeah.
Folks, we have a new Facebook page. I just wanted to tell you a little bit about it. The Facebook page that it went up on the website last week, and we already have about 15 people following us. I think it's too soon right now, but I think it's going to be very popular. And with the Facebook page, you can go to the website on the homepage, go to the bottom of the homepage, and you'll see the Facebook page that our engineer and computer extraordinaire, Eric Otero, put it up for us last week, and we've got some pictures there for us. It's facebook.com/EAL Radio, EAL Radio. And with this Facebook page, you can put pictures on it. You can put videos if you've got a video that you can install yourself right on the Facebook page. So we want to see some Eastern blogs, I guess, on Facebook. I'm just really finding my way around Facebook. My kids, grandchildren, are you guys pretty savvy on that, Steve and Bill, Facebook?
Yeah, I'm familiar with it. Yes, I'm a Facebook savvy.
Qualified?
Yes. That's how I keep up with my grandchildren.
Well, some people are kind of a little bit leery about going on it and putting too much stuff on it because it does spread kind of like wildfire. But we want to kind of keep it, this Facebook page anyhow, we want to keep it to Eastern stuff. And we're encouraging people that are family members, our friends. As a matter of fact, I got a question there about the young lady that is standing the doorway of the boarding doorway of the DC-7B that we have in the DC-7B Foundation that I haven't heard much of here lately about it flying. So maybe we can get Roger Jarman to come back on our show and tell us a little bit about what's happening with the DC-7B. And have you guys heard any news about where they're flying it to or whether they're using it on Pan American? The series, Pan American TV series, they've used it, I think, twice now.
Yeah, I think so.
And put the Pan American brand on the side of the airplane.
Right. I assume that'd probably be tied up for that program, wouldn't it?
Well, I've heard that they're about to take it off the air, but I don't want to spread any rumors, but I don't know whether that's true or not. But have you seen a show? You guys seen any of the series of Pan Am?
I saw part of it.
I saw one, and I can tell you it is not a wife-approved story.
That's so true.
Well, that makes I think I want to see it.
Nor a single woman such as myself either. I did not care for it.
A lot of truth in that series, right?
Yeah.
That's funny. I never met any like that, though.
I think I'll change the subject. Would everybody like me to do that?
Yeah, would you change the subject?
Yes. You know, we talked in this presentation tonight about all these Root Awards and things, and, of course, that was under the Civil Aeronautics Board pre-1978 when the Deregulation Act was approved. And in the country here, you could just about go wherever you wanted to, and that's how we built a small hub out in Kansas City, if you guys remember that.
Yeah.
I hope you do.
Yeah.
But then on the other side of the coin, when we got those Root Awards that Steve was talking about, particularly the one to England, through the CAB, we ended up, if my memory serves me right, going out to Gatwick instead of the preferred airport, which, of course, was Heathrow.
Right.
Yeah.
That's correct. Exactly.
Gatwick certainly didn't provide the same sales opportunities that a flight into Heathrow would have provided.
No.
Right.
Yeah.
I wanted to mention another thing. If I didn't tell you on my reenactment of the PA announcement going to Aruba that the flight number there was 999, if I didn't mention it then, I want to mention it again. And of course, there's a message there also.
What's the message?
Is the message that you're supporting Herman Cain for president?
Yes.
How did you guess?
Well, I got to go out and plow some snow. I'll see you guys later.
So you can pay your sales tax.
Yeah. Speaking of airline and our Root Awards, I can remember a couple of them. Carib Air, of course, when it came on board, and we took a lot of the Carib Air, well, we took all of the Carib Air pilots. And some of them I had taught for their airline transport rating, ATRs we call them in those days, when my school that I was operating in Atlanta, we would fly down and train some of the guys for their ATPs and mechanics license. We taught the ground school for taking the written examination for the airline transport pilot rating. And a lot of our students were Carib Air pilots and also the Prince Air pilots. So Puerto Rican International Airline was a competitor of Carib Air. And if you guys remember, do you remember anything unusual about the Prince Air? Can you remember, Steve, flying into San Juan and seeing those Prince Air airplanes? Can you tell me what was, huh?
They're herons, weren't they?
They were herons, but what was the unusual thing about all of those airplanes?
Well,
they were all herons.
They had four engines.
Four engines. What else?
Four, that's right.
Four engines and, oh, God.
Boy, they were so many of them, as I remember.
And they were all different colors. They were all different colors.
That's
they looked like Easter eggs.
Yeah.
Looked just like Piranha.
And I think, Eric, you are from San Juan, aren't you? You're from Puerto Rico? Yeah. Your family's from Puerto Rico, yeah. But it was a good little airline. It really was. I remember that, and you guys probably remember also that they were in the clouds and they were being controlled by San Juan Center, and they were actually ran into the hills, the mountains of Puerto Rico, and it killed the crew and the passengers. They only had just a few passengers on the airplane. Do you recall that, Steve?
Yes, I do, but I don't remember any of the details of it, though.
Yeah, they ran them right the blame was put on the air traffic control center.
Right.
For putting them over in that vicinity and giving them a low altitude, and they ran them right in. I think it was over at, what was the name of it, El Yunquin, the rainforest there? I think it's called El Yunquin in that area. That's where they hit.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Well, the airline that we acquired, and I was fortunate enough when I first came with Eastern to get to fly those routes. And in my career with Eastern, 30-whatever years it was, there were routes that we acquired from other airlines or were awarded that were the most fun routes to fly. And the colonial routes that I started out with in 1957, we call them the back, I don't remember, we had a name for those colonial routes, but it was the most challenging flying that I probably have ever done, especially in the wintertime. And we'd land in 4 to 6 inches of snow and take off and think nothing of it and not even calculate the drag that the snow would on takeoff. But it was and some of the most beautiful scenery that I've ever flown in, and challenging. But it was really fun. And I can tell you another thing about the Colonial pilots. They were, of all of the pilots I ever flew with, they were the characters that we could write books about.
Especially a guy named Al Brelaud and Whitey John. Bless their hearts. Great Colonial
pilots. Oh,
those
were the good guys.
Those were the good guys.
I mean,
they really were.
Oh, yes, yes. But there were some guys that could... they were just, I'm trying to think of some of their names, but they were just real characters.
Charlie Tenstedt. You remember Charlie? Charlie Tenstedt. He just died here about a couple of months ago. Charlie was a super nice guy, really nice guy.
Yes. Yeah.
But
and then of course with the South American routes.
Well, before
and
you get to off
a,
of Colombia,
to a real to a and I hate to use that term, but to a pilot who dislikes being told what to do with his airplane, you got to fly that airplane, and probably 50% of the time, you didn't even have radar contact.
Oh, no.
And you did things, you kind of owned your own, and that's what you had the ability or freedom to do, of course, as long as it was safe, but it was just absolutely fun flying.
You know, Steve, to bring you back to Colonial just a minute, you mentioned something that I thought about when I did a little research for the tonight show. I was looking at the Colonial history, and that they had about 12 crashes, several of them with many fatalities. They lost about 12 airplanes during their history. And I just wondered whether a lot of that was contributed to the weather they were flying in, because they flew through some terrible winter operations and conditions with the snow the way it was, you know. And so you flew that.
I'm sure it was. And of course, up until the time that I started flying it, most of those routes were flown with DC-3s.
Yeah, yeah.
And I can tell you from experience that a loaded DC-3 with ice doesn't fly very long.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas we came in with the Martin 404s with that heated wing, and it was a piece of cake almost, except for the snow on the runways, which had very limited air service to them.
Was the tail heated?
On the DC-3, no. It was just the boots on the. I think it was the de-icing, which was boot operated.
Okay.
On the DC-3, the difference between de-icing and I-icing was air and
That's right.
And the rubber...
The rubber expander boots.
Expander boots. But, yeah, I think also Colonial operated DC-4s or DC-6s on their Bermuda operations from Washington.
They did.
New York.
Right.
And so... And I believe that's exactly the way Eastern came about flying to Bermuda, was because of the purchase of Colonial Airlines, if I'm not mistaken.
I think you're correct.
Yeah, yeah. But I enjoyed flying to Bermuda, too. It was a lot of fun flying there. But one of the closest I've ever experienced, you know, people ask you if they find out if you flew for the airlines or you were a pilot with the airlines, what was... What was your worst
experience?
Scariest besides flying in a Bermuda Triangle, but but one of the things that I remember so well was flying out of Buffalo one snowy, stormy evening when we flew Atlanta to Buffalo and Buffalo to Toronto, and I was with Gib Garrett, one of my favorite captains to fly with from Atlanta, and we were in an L-1011. This is when I had been demoted, and we took a furlough, and some of the guys had to go back to the right seat instead of flying, you know, the left seat. And I was flying with Gib that night, and we had a snowstorm that you wouldn't believe. I mean, the tower, the ground control just couldn't even see us. They asked us to tell us when we got to the approach, I mean, the departure end of the runway, takeoff end. And so we got out there, and if you remember Buffalo, it had kind of a crown to the runway. I can still remember that night. And it kind of went uphill and then downhill as you flew toward the city. And so we got down there, and it was snowing. You just could not believe the snow. It took us forever to get down to the end of the runway. And then we had wind. And so the controller had cleared Allegheny to land right before we took off, and ask Allegheny to tell the ground control when he was on ground, when he was off the runway. Well, Allegheny couldn't see enough to tell when they were off the runway, and their tail was still sticking out over the runway. And so they had told ground that they were off the runway, and so they cleared us for departure. So we took off, and I remember that I was flying the airplane. Gib was, I was flying to Buffalo. He had flown up to, I was flying to Toronto, rather, and he flew the Buffalo leg from Atlanta. And just as we rotated, Gib said, "My God, there's a DC-9's tail." Just real quickly, he said, "There's an airplane." He didn't say a DC-9, but that's what it was. And, I mean, the airplane had already been rotated, the 1011. We were in a 1011. And just as I rotated, I just quickly glanced, and sure enough, there was this Allegheny airplane. And I don't know whether I was in the air at the time and just cleared the top of that tail or not, but had we not rotated before that, we would have definitely hit his tail. Gib was the most upset I have ever seen. Gib Garin, and you, if you Steve, you know Gib Garin and how
yeah, it would take a lot.
He's a gentleman. I mean, he's a gentleman, but not that night. Boy, he came unglued. It scared him because he was right there and saw the whole thing on his side of the airplane. But that was one of those nights that, you know, you have some close calls, and that was my close call. But any other
stories? Speaking of Buffalo, I had one. I was flying night cargo on a 727. It was a snowy night, and they had cleared the runway and had sanded it. But what they forgot to do was sand the tarmac or sand the ramp area. So as we slowed down to get off the runway and apply the brakes ever so gently, there was no braking action whatsoever, and it started to accelerate. You talk about a pucker factor.
Yeah.
I had all three of those engines in reverse. Thank God it stopped us, because we were headed for the terminal.
My golly. Yeah.
It was just amazing.
Yeah. Some of the experiences. Our engineer has got an airport that I can't identify on our screen right now. Would you tell us where you've got us over now?
What'd you get?
San Juan, Puerto Rico. It's also called Isla Verde Airport. Or is it Isla Grande? Steve, do you remember?
Isla Verde. East La Grande you could walk to from the hotel where we laid over.
That's right. That was a general aviation where the military was flying out of, East La Grande. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
He's got us right. Google Earth is really wonderful. That's instead of playing solitaire and Minesweep, I usually go to Google Earth. And if you've ever been to Google Earth lately, if you don't have, do you guys have Google Earth, Bill and Steve?
Yes, I do.
You know, Neil, when you ask a question like that, you make it sound like I'm in another world all the time. Do you have this? Do you have that? I got everything you've got, Neil.
Well, okay, then you have experience driving down the street with Google Earth. You can take the little guy and put him right in the middle of the street, and you can chase cars down the street. It's just amazing.
I can tell you, speaking of electronic devices, I just bought an iPad 2, and I downloaded Flight Book, and there's another aviation chart application, and I can take that iPad 2, and I've been flying a 172, some U.S. Forest Service patrol, and I take that iPad 2 with me, and it moves with me on a map, an IFR chart or a VFR chart. And also, I can shoot an approach with it, and it shows the airplane, and it turns with me, and I am so impressed with that. That if you have an iPad 2, and it's got its own built-in GPS, which is I'm just blown away with this technology.
Now wait a minute, Steve. Are you saying that you can just take the iPad in your left and right hand and move the pad itself as you would be moving the control column?
No,
You have to mash the buttons.
You take the iPad 2 and open the cover and select the approach chart that you want, or the VFR chart, the IFR chart, and you can see your airplane right there moving with you. But you still got to fly the airplane.
Okay, so what do you use for the controls, the elevators, ailerons, and...
No. I misstated my case. This is just it's like an electronic flight bag that is in the form of an iPad 2. It's like a little computer that you can hold in your hand, and you can follow your flight path on this iPad 2.
And what are you doing this in an airplane? Are you doing it? You said
a 172.
Oh, you've got a 172.
No, I've been doing a little bit of U.S. Forest Service work for a local FBO up in Hillsville, Virginia.
Okay, very good, very good. So you could actually use this almost to make an approach, then, couldn't you?
You really can. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
So it's just something I thought might be of interest to you guys if you're doing some flying.
What else do you have out there in Colorado, Bill? Besides,
I usually get up in the morning when the 757 from Federal Express lands from Colorado Springs. That's what gets me going.
That gets you going. Well, it's been fun this evening. I want to give a little... trailer of information for our show Halloween. Make sure that listeners that you do tune in Halloween, because we've got one scary flight fright for you.
You're gonna
scary
like it.
Flight
You're
fright.
Really
You're
gonna
really
like
gonna
it.
Like it. But we just have just a few, not even a few minutes. I guess about 1 minute left. So we'll say good night for now. And we certainly enjoyed being with you. We hope you'll tune in next week at same time, Monday, 7 p.m., and we will be on Flight 41, Episode 41, or Eastern Flight 41. So for tonight, that's our show where all the Eastern family, where all the women are unequal, all the men are good-looking, and all the children and grandchildren are above average. Let's all say
good night, Margaret, Bill, Steve, and Neil.
Good night, Bill, Neil, Steve, Bud.
Good night, Margaret, Neil, Steve, and Bud.
Good night.
Good night, Bill, Margaret, Steve, Bud, and Lou Ann, if you're still here.
I certainly am. Good night, you all. And as I always say, make sure you fly right side up. We'll see you next week.
Good night.
Good night, Eastern.
Good night, everybody.
Hate to wake you up to say goodbye, but the dawn is breaking, it's early morn. The taxi's waiting, he's blown his horn. Already I'm so lonesome I could die. So kiss me and smile for me, tell me that you wait for me, hold me like you'll never let me go. 'Cause I'm leaving on a jet plane, don't know when I'll be back again. Oh babe, I hate to go. There's so many times I've let you down, so many times I've played around. I tell you now, they don't mean a thing. Every place I go, I'll think of you. Every song I sing, I'll sing for you. When I come back, I'll bring your wedding ring. So kiss me and smile for me, tell me that you'll wait for me, hold me like you'll never let me go. 'Cause I'm leaving on a jet plane, don't know when I'll be back again. Oh babe, I hate to go. Times